Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
It's Friday, so it's time to catch up on what happened across Chicago and Illinois the past few days in our weekly news recap. We'll go behind the headlines with local journalists working on stories like these.
You're seeing people waving American flags in St. Peter's Square. Pope Leo, the former Cardinal Prevost, Chicago native.
The new nonprofit arm of the city will provide low-cost short-term loans to housing developers.
The mayor's plan is to install his deputy mayor, Christina Paseon-Isaias, into the role.
I was witnessing an effort to install a mayoral preference.
The person that I select will reflect the values of my administration.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. To help make sense of the week's news, we sat down with Brandon Pope, reporter and anchor at WCIU, Mitchell Armentrout, government and politics reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, and Chris Jones, editorial page editor and theater critic for the Chicago Tribune. Now, in big news for Chicago Catholics, the new Pope is 69-year-old Robert Francis Prevost, who's got deep local roots.
South Side.
Pretty awesome.
Born at Mercy Hospital in Bronzeville. He grew up in South Suburban Dalton, attended school there, sang in the choir, served as an altar boy at St. Mary's on the far South Side. Prevost attended the Catholic Theology Union in Hyde Park between 78 and 1982. During that time, he taught in local Catholic schools, including St. Rita, where he was a substitute teacher. So much to his story. Dual citizenship, too, right? The U.S. and Peru.
Mm-hmm.
Spent a lot of time.
Speaks three languages, too.
Three languages. I thought it was just the two.
Yeah. English, Italian, and Spanish.
English, mm-hmm. Italian, and Spanish. Lived for years in Peru and was a missionary first and then archbishop. But after the news broke yesterday, I'm sure you all saw, you were on social media, you were on, you had a phone in your hands. It didn't take long for those memes, did it?
No, pretty much immediate. Yeah.
Immediate.
It's like, very quick.
Chicagoans were thrilled and they went right to social media to tell us. They reacted with the Pope memes.
Uh-huh.
He was eating Italian beef sandwiches.
A lot of
baptized,
deep dish pizza.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. That, you had Malort.
Malort, serving Malort.
Yeah, yeah.
Tavern style pizza at communion.
And of course, the furious debate over, is he a Cubs fan or a Sox fan?
Right, which there was a lot of confusion around that yesterday.
Well,
I don't know what sparked it.
There's still confusion around
so what,
it.
What sparked it?
Yes,
what sparked
is.
It is ABC News during their live broadcast said he's a Cubs fan.
Yeah.
And no one really knows where that came from.
Is that
right?
Where I got it from? Because I went on air yesterday.
Okay, yes.
I went on air.
ABC News.
I took calls and I saw it on Twitter. It must have been ABC News. But then also the Cubs Twitter account.
They took it and ran, and then they were quickly debunked
by the Sun Times.
We've got to give credit to our colleagues,
yes.
Caitlin Washburn and Ashley Resin at the Sun Times, who got the scoop on a photo from a close family friend,
yes.
of the new Pope, showing him on a very dated cell phone at a 2005 World Series game on the South Side. So,
and then WGN talked to his brother, who was like, I don't know where this Cubs thing came from. He's always been a Sox fan.
So, yeah. Well, then I guess, you know, I'm going to believe the brother of all people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I'd love to hear from the Pope himself, though.
Like, yes.
We need that sit down. Just go into every Chicago thing.
My team is working on it right now. They're on the phones calling his people, trying to get us connected. I saw cover art for, like, new TV series starring Prevost. So, like, you know, we've got Chicago Med, Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, and I saw Chicago Pope.
Oh, man.
Was surrounded by doctors behind him. It was a little ridiculous. Mayor Johnson jumped in. He went on X/Twitter and said everything dope, including the Pope, comes from Chicago. Of course, a nod to Sherman Dilla Thomas.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're awesome. You're no longer the original Chicago Pope,
yeah.
Brandon Pope.
Slid to the fifth round.
Someone,
you know, I was hoping I'd have my name drawn in that that conclave, but so much for that.
Was anyone surprised, though, by the fact that Robert Prevost was America's first Pope?
I was. He was definitely in the pool of people they talked about, but you know, there's always, when you talk about the papacy and you talk about the conclaves, there's this stigma around America and American ideals and things like that overall. And so many folks thought that would hold him back.
Right.
And not get the votes he needed to ascend. But we were wrong. he must have really done some work in that room, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. And in retrospect, I mean, when you look at it, this is like such a Chicago sort of ascent, you know? Mm-hmm. In his role in the Vatican, he was really the guy behind the scenes placing bishops around the world. Like, this is a guy who's been turning the levers for a long time.
And, mm-hmm.
you know, there was obviously... the consensus was that, yeah, it was not going to be an American pope, let alone a Chicago pope.
Yeah, lots of people said it was a long shot.
But, you know, that's how Chicagoans kind of operate in politics, you know?
Coming just kind of
working
on top.
It behind the scenes.
Well, congrats to Pope Leo XIV. I do want to pivot to something on a more serious note, though. There's certainly a lot of local excitement, as we know, around this election, but it does come with some concern. The Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, which is based right here in Chicago, they did file a complaint back in March that the now Pope had actually covered up sexual abuse in Chicago and Peru. This morning, Morning Edition spoke with Sean Doherty, board president of SNAP.
It has been reported that he has willingly protected priests that did, in fact, sexually assault children under their watch. And for that reason, our view is that he is not qualified to be the Pope. The children under his watch aren't safe.
So that's certainly something we'll keep an eye on here at WBEZ. Let's turn to some other local news, because believe it or not, other things did happen this week. We are at the halfway point officially of Brandon Johnson's four-year term. The mayor had major wins this week with alders approving his ambitious green social housing plan, Mitch. A unique strategy. What does it entail?
Right. So this is basically the mayor's top priority at this point. It's a measure that's intended to increase the pool of affordable housing units in Chicago. And basically what this does is it's going to take about $135 million from the $1 billion that the city borrowed last year to work on projects like this. And basically what it's going to do is provide lower interest loans to developers who agree to develop essentially more affordable units in the mm-hmm. housing that they create. And, you know, the critiques of this program kind of run both ways. There are folks who say that, one, this is only going to create, it's estimated to create like 40 or so units per year as it starts out. But there are also folks who say that, you know, it doesn't do enough to attract development to under-resourced neighborhoods, predominantly Black and Latino neighborhoods, where development and affordable housing is most lacking. But the mayor, you know, this is a big win for him, because it's, how many times have we been on this show talking about, you know, his administration basically just kind of tripping over itself?
That's right.
A lot of political misfires. But he can really chalk this up as kind of a big win as we reach, you know, the exact midpoint of his tenure.
Yeah. Do you agree, Chris? Is this a big win for the mayor?
I think this is probably an okay thing. I think it depends how much you trust the city of Chicago to be a property developer, essentially, or to be involved in the game of developing property. I think, you know, when we've spoken with private developers, they've often said better just to let the market take care of it. And really what they always say is, if you can cut the red tape, they point to cities like Austin, Texas, where there's been an enormous increase in the housing stock there. And, you know, guess what? Rents come down when there is more available housing. It's not right. that difficult. You know, I think, as Mitch says, this is only a small number of units. On the other issue going on with affordable housing in this city, I think we keep hearing is, of course, the cost of these units that can range up to $800,000, $900,000 a unit in some cases.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the other good thing that would be good here, I think, is, and I think this is actually kind of part of it, is the ability to renovate buildings as well as build from scratch. Because mm-hmm. we have all these derelict buildings and that you could actually turn into affordable housing more cheaply than always buying new. But I think it's worth trying, I guess, is my opinion.
Yeah. To that point, Brandon, do you think that Chicago could join those other cities and also be seen as a model, especially when folks are grappling with homelessness and affordable housing? It's a big issue across the country.
Absolutely. And Chicago is the biggest city that we know of that's tried something like this. So we don't know how it's really going to work out because it is something new, but there's no doubt Chicago has a crisis here when it comes to a lack of affordable housing, a major deficit of it. And so this is a rare win for Brandon Johnson in terms of like accomplishing things he kind of ran on, right? As you mentioned, a lot of stumbles out the gate. He can actually look back and say, well, at least we got this passed through, even though there's lots of debate. Yeah. Most older people that even disagree with the mayor ended up saying, well, we at least can agree this is a good idea.
This makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's stick with Mayor Johnson. The ongoing drama that's happening over at the Chicago Public Schools with the CEO, that's taken a new turn, Chris. What is the latest chapter in that saga?
Well, I think, you know, in essence, you have very transactional behavior on the part of the Johnson administration there in the sense that they want a specific person. And we all know who that is. And they
say the name.
I'll let you say.
Christina Passione Zayas, his chief of staff. He wants her to serve as the interim CEO.
Right. So there is a requirement that was put into place by the Board of Education that the new superintendent of the Chicago schools would have a superintendent's license. And the reason that was put into place, ironically, was to prevent business people and political hacks, you might say, from taking those jobs. Mm-hmm. And here we have somebody who I would say is qualified in, you know, highly educated, has a doctorate, I believe. But still, that requirement is there. And so it's like, well, you know, if you want that requirement when it doesn't suit you, is it okay then just to sort of pretend to try and remove it? Or, you know, what we heard yesterday was that the whipping of votes was going on among that board, an elected board, to remove the requirement, the very same people who had just proposed it, because that now didn't fit somebody that the mayor wanted. And I would argue that's problematic.
Mm. Yeah. Che Rheinfest-Smith, who's a board member from the 10th district on the far south side, introduced the March resolution. He responded, quote, "I feel like it's an attack on the school board being an independent body, an attack on democracy."
Quite right.
Which, tough words, but I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
He also compared it to what the Trump administration has done by appointing people like Elon Musk and close friends and allies, Fox News personalities and things like that.
Oh, so he had more to say.
He did have more to say. So, you know, maybe not a exact, you know, comparison that makes exact sense, but the idea and premise behind it, the fact that, you know, the mayor is going in and saying, no, this person, and trying to flex some muscle there to try to get his person in, it is going to be seen problematic by an elected school board, a school board that feels like, okay, we are empowered by the people we represent, not the person at the top of City Hall right now. And that we're getting a very early look here what these dynamics are like. And it's going to be interesting to see how Johnson navigates this, because he can't really bend will he be able to bend really the will of this city, this school board, like he was able to with other ones that he appointed?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like he's going to, especially with people like Rheinfest-Smith, who were like, I'm just not going to sit idly by and let that happen.
It seems doubtful at this point. Before we leave Chicago Public Schools, a former Chicago elementary school principal who was supposed to be sentenced in a kickback scheme this week was found dead. Brandon, fill us in.
Yeah. She was supposed to show up for a sentencing hearing. We're talking about 61-year-old Sarah Jackson Abedelal. She was principal at Brenneman Elementary, pleaded guilty in 2022 to stealing $300,000from the CPS school. So this trial has been going on for a while. Her sentencing was scheduled for Tuesday. She was a no-show. The judge was like, okay, we got to find her. No one had heard from her. Then Wednesday, the attorney comes up and says, yeah, we found out that she's dead. She was pronounced dead on Tuesday, found at a friend's house.
Any word on what happened?
We still do not know the cause of death. She was found at a friend's home in Country Club Hills.
Wow.
The prosecutors are pushing for a 3-year prison sentence for her. Sad overall to see a sudden loss like that. And she had spoken. The attorney says that she had shown attrition, that she was, you know, reflective of her life, and she admitted to this mistake and pleaded guilty. So still lots to look into there, but definitely sad to see someone, die like that.
What a tragic ending to that story.
Yeah.
I want to keep you in the hot seat for just another moment here, Brandon, to tell us about one of the mayor's leadership picks that's getting pushed back. Another leadership pick, if you will, getting pushed back. This one, though, related to the CTA.
As the world turns with Mayor Brandon Johnson, right? So, look, CTA, it's embattled. And who leads it is going to be a thing people are going to be talking about for a long time. a lot of transit advocates, they want someone who has experience with public transportation, running a transit agency, and having experience writing public transportation. Mayor Johnson's pick, the city COO, John Roberson, doesn't have that. He is a city hall veteran, worked under Mayor Daley. He was aviation commissioner, so he does have some, I guess you could say, travel experience, but not so much when it comes to buses, trains, and the complicated situation of like lobbying for federal funding and the fiscal cliff that CTA is facing right now. And so activists, they wrote a letter to Brandon Johnson and to the board chair, Lester Barclay, and they are hoping that they can try to get the mayor to reconsider and open up the pool to try to get someone who fits those qualifications they see fit. So there's no strict timeline here that the mayor has given on when he wants to make that pick. But Roberson is who he's trying to rally the board to do. And here's something to look out for. This could be another Pritzker versus Johnson potential battle here because Governor Pritzker.
No, it was going so well.
You know, things, the honeymoon phase, definitely over.
Yeah.
The mayor controls four of the seats on that CTA board, and Pritzker controls three. So it's going to be interesting to hear what Governor Pritzker thinks about all this going forward.
Wednesday was the first day that you were supposed to need a real ID or a passport in order to fly. Anybody pass that real ID super center that's down at
Lines.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
It is very long.
People were in line at 4 a.m. It doesn't open until 7:30.
Oh, wow.
But Wednesday did end up being sort of a typical day at O'Hare and Midway because the government announced another grace period. So they're going to get more time. Are you at all perplexed at just the amount of real confusion this real ID saga has caused, Chris?
You know, I think it just took too long because this was approved, 15 years ago, 13 years ago.
Right.
So if no one is trusted, it's actually going to go
I mean, I was
into...
still running around with my Maryland state ID and just realized, I'm like, oh, I've had a real ID for years.
Yeah,
why are we just talking about this now in Illinois?
It's kind of crazy. And I remember going to the DMV and getting my license renewed and not getting real ID because that was another hour and a half in line.
Yeah.
So I decided not to bother. But I use a global entry card. So if you have, you know, if you have global entry, that's the easiest way to do it. That's a real ID.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, a passport works for a lot of people.
Yes.
Federal ID. And there's other military IDs. It's not like there aren't other real IDs than driving licenses. So
right.
I think most people can probably, particularly people who don't fly that often, they don't have to stand in line, wait till it calms down, use your passport a couple of times, use your, you know, another federal ID you may have. And then, you know, I think the Secretary of State has said this, please wait until this craziness is over.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a long wait. I could see it. I was on the train, actually. I would see it snaking around, you know, right by the L tracks. It's crazy.
Oh, my goodness.
All the way around the building.
Mitch, were you secretly in that lineup?
No, actually, I miraculously got mine a few months ago.
Oh,
actually,
very good.
Wow.
I realized my ID had expired after my birthday, which completely caught me off guard, and I managed to snag an appointment.
You raced down. Took care of it. While I've got you in the hot seat, and before we take a pause, I want you to fill us in here. Chicago's proposed Riverfront Casino has been making headlines. What's happening?
Right. So actually, courtesy of the Sun-Times, construction has been on hold for the last week of Bally's permanent casino over at Chicago Avenue in Halsted.
Uh-oh.
And that's because my colleague, Bob Hergeth, just happened to be walking by the construction site, and he noticed a bunch of D&P construction dumpsters, which if that name doesn't jump out to you, I can't blame you. Going back about 20 years, this is a company that was once linked by the FBI to organized crime figures in Chicago, the DeFranzo brothers, if anyone is well-versed in kind of Chicago outfit history.
Wow.
Hard to say if this company is still has any organized crime ties, but it's enough of even a whiff of any connection to organized crime is enough for the Illinois Gaming Board to shut
for
down
good
construction.
Reason.
What a turn this is taking.
It's like something out of a TV show.
Right.
It's a Tony Soprano.
And very Chicago.
And another controversy involving the casino. Bally's original proposal guaranteed 25% equity to women and people of color. Where are we at with that?
So Bally's basically, they're under their agreement with former Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who picked Bally's to run this casino. She insisted that the city or the casino be owned at least 25% by women or basically minority-owned businesses. And due to a series of lawsuits, basically inspired by anti-DEI efforts by the Trump administration. Mm. Bally's has really reworked that proposal. They say they'll still have a 25% minority investment level, but there's not really going to be any actual, contractual requirement for that.
You know, does this put the project at risk?
It could. I mean, there's been financial problems kind of at every step of the way here. So we'll see.
I don't understand quite what they're saying. And I've read it about 100 times. It's like they're not going to have this requirement now because they've decided that doesn't pass muster. So then how, in fact, are they going to ensure this? Because that's not what they are. So there's a lot of vagueness about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, my thought is that it will get done eventually. But if you look at under the terms of that arrangement, they're supposed to be a lot farther along than they are now. And if you walk by there, there's not a lot of casino in the ground yet.
Nothing
so
happening.
Whether we're going to make that deadline, we'll have to see.
All right, time to head down to Springfield, Mitch, which is where Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem was on Wednesday. What was she up to?
She made the trip to Springfield basically to highlight sanctuary policies in Illinois and Chicago, too. She managed to get in a few parting glances at the city. Basically, the situation a couple of years ago in Springfield was a 24-year-old woman was killed by a boyfriend who lacked legal status. She was stabbed to death in Springfield. And Kristi Noem kind of used this sort of to kind of create a platform to talk about the policies in Illinois that prohibit or at least limit the cooperation that local law enforcement can have with federal immigration authorities in terms of deporting people.
Let's hear a bit from her directly, and then I'll get some more from you on the back end, Mitch.
This is the block where a young woman was killed. Just a couple of houses away from here, Emma Schaefer was brutally stabbed and murdered by an illegal alien who was released into the United States by the Biden administration.
So tell us more about the kind of welcome she got, but also how Schaefer's parents responded to what she's saying here.
So it's hard to say exactly what the PR strategy was here because Kristi Noem's press team hasn't really communicated much with the media. But the original plan was to sort of stage this press conference outside the governor's mansion, where there ended up being a very large counter-protest presence. So they ended up moving this press conference to the home of the family of Emma Schaefer, which became awkward because her parents released a statement basically begging her to just stop using Emma Schaefer as sort of holding her up as an example of policies that Schaefer herself, they say, wouldn't agree with. By all accounts, Schaefer was a community organizer who was very invested in a lot of progressive causes, specifically in terms of immigration. Parents basically said this was an insult to her memory.
Yeah, part of their statement read, Noem's words are in direct conflict with who Emma was as a person. Emma built up the community and stood with all members, including immigrants, end quote.
So really just kind of a very awkward sort of press conference that Governor J.B. Pritzker and other Democrats in Springfield just tried to pounce on.
Yeah.
It's just kind of an example of painting it as, a really ugly political ploy, using this really tragic case to...
And she had tough words for Pritzker?
Correct, yeah. No, she, Kristi Noem herself, this is kind of this was viewed as an opportunity to sort of, take some real heavy shots at just kind of Democrats across Illinois. The Trump administration has really painted the state and the city as sort of a haven of crime and dysfunction, which, as a result of immigration, which, just isn't really borne out in... any crime statistics that, news organizations have been able to compile. So, this is really just sort of highlighting again this huge divide between the Trump administration and Governor Pritzker and other Democrats across the state.
Brandon, are you thinking that Noem's visit signals President Trump's targeting Pritzker, who, as we know, has been seen as this potential presidential candidate for 2028?
And we know that President Trump never stops campaigning, even if he doesn't have a possible way of being president.
He can't be president again for a third term.
Even though he dances around that. But still, he's definitely targeting Pritzker here. He sees Pritzker, I'm sure, as a big threat, not just to his MAGA movement, but also midterms coming up here. And the reason why, Pritzker's one of the only guys out there who got the money to go blow for blow with him.
Yeah.
He can fund people in downstate races all across the country, not just Illinois. And then he can run his own campaign self-funded if he wanted to. He's got the momentum. He's got the funding. He's got the support and backing. And so there's no doubt Trump, he watches a lot of cable news. He watches.
He does.
And so he sees the talk about J.B. Pritzker being a front runner. He's trying to squash that early.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, the governor, as we've talked about, been very openly critical of Trump, especially with tariffs. There's another billionaire, former Chicagoan Ken Griffin, also expressing opposition to the tariff issue. Mm-hmm. Are you detecting more cracks in that Republican support for the president?
Well, I think people like Ken Griffin, who are obviously business people, they support free trade, which I think anyone with a clue supports, sees the advantages of free trade, and seen today with the deal with the UK now that there's this baseline 10% tariffs, and a lot of
tariffs hit him where it hurts.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the talk of tariffs, you know, Trump has used these massive numbers, like in the case of China, 140%, now saying, well, just 80%, but still 80%. So, you know, I think the general view of the business community is that tariffs are a bad idea. And people like the Wall Street Journal have been hammering away on tariffs. We've been hammering away on tariffs at the Tribune. I don't think anybody in the world of Ken Griffin thinks that tariffs are a good idea.
Mm-hmm. While Secretary Noem was in Springfield, Pritzker was signing a state executive order. This is banning the unauthorized collection of autism information, Brandon. What's this about?
Yeah.
It's a privacy issue?
It's all the way a privacy issue here. So we know Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the new health secretary, has taken over, and he's made autism sort of one of his big crusades. But he's also a guy that has a lot of controversial views around autism and flat out wrong things he said. He's linked childhood vaccines to autism. And so he said he wants to have a collection effort to find the root causes of autism. And that would be tracking folks with autism, using Medicare and Medicaid data. Pritzker signed this executive order and saying we're not going to allow that here in the state. There are still some, the way the executive order is written, it basically prohibits state agencies from allowing the distribution of data that is personably identifiable for autism, people with autism.
Yeah.
However, it does have the caveat of unless it violates the law to bar that. So if the federal government were to really flex a muscle here and say, no, we need that data, you have quite a fight on your hands and potentially legal hurdles
argument
going on.
Interesting. Yeah. One more Springfield story. This is concerning legislation that would let volunteers ease worker shortages in healthcare, Chris. The Tribune published an editorial about it, didn't they?
So this is a sort of a bizarre thing. So in essence, what this was really about is that let's say you're a doctor and you retire, but you keep your license. You're a licensed person. And let's say there's a crisis akin to COVID and you decide that you're going to volunteer. You're going to go back into the hospital and you're going to help people in need. You actually had to relicense yourself, or in fact you have under the current situation, you have to get another license because you're now a volunteer, not an employee. I mean, it's crazy, right? That would discourage medical professionals volunteering. Again, it's not about not having a license. It's about the difference between one license path here for an employee, one for a volunteer. Mm-hmm. Crazy. Who could possibly oppose that? So, I mean, how did it even exist? So I think it'll be good if this passes.
Yeah. All right. Time to turn to the Senate and congressional races that are heating up. Democratic Representatives Raja Krishnamoorthy and Robin Kelly, they've entered the race officially for Dick Durbin's Senate seat. What should we know here, Mitch?
Well, it's a three-horse race now, potentially a fourth soon.
They joined Stratton, right?
Exactly, yeah. Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, she kind of came out of the gate really hard, you know, with an endorsement from Governor Pritzker, which would certainly signal a financial wherewithal for a campaign that is really going to be a slugfest. U.S. Rep. Robin Kelly from the South Suburbs, you know, she's been a fixture in Congress for the Chicago area for a long time. She's going to have major backing, too. But Raja Krishnamoorthy, who's been a congressman for the Northwest Suburbs for almost a decade, he's just kind of, he's one of the most prolific fundraisers in all of the U.S. Congress. So it's really hard to kind of pick a favorite at this point. We've obviously got almost a year of campaigning ahead. And it's going to be...
I have no idea where this is going to go.
Yeah.
No guesses.
You also just have the confusion around how is the vote going to get split up here? I mean, you have Stratton who's jumped in, Robin Kelly right after, and then Lauren Underwood is still mulling whether she wants to jump in this or not. The implications around that with Underwood's congressional seat potentially up for grabs and maybe getting Republican control if she jumps in. But also, we all know black women are the backbone of the Democratic base. Would they be splitting the vote? Would all, would, you know, some are asking why'd Robin Kelly even jump in when Stratton, as you mentioned, came out the gate right away and
so
kind of built up some a sense of inevitability by having
the backing of Pritzker.
Well, so it's tough. Go ahead.
I know. I think we argued that the governor shouldn't overpush his own lieutenant governor, that the people deserve the chance. Illinoisans deserve the chance.
You talking about the Tribune piece from Laura Washington?
Yes, that certainly Laura wrote about that. We also wrote an editorial saying, you know, Governor, hey, let the candidates stand up first. Let people, it's been a long time since this seat was vacant. Let's let people make a choice between all the qualified candidates we can find. It's not meant to be a coronation. Right. And obviously he's entitled to make an endorsement, I think. I think he's entitled to put his financial resources behind his preferred candidate.
Sure.
But it's not supposed to be like, oh, by the way, it's all over. And I think it looks a little bit that way at first. It was like, it was all a little too smoothly coordinated. Now I think, as Mitch says, it's changed. We've got other people in the race who are very credible. That's good at this point. It's still a ways away.
And voters don't always respond well to coronation. No, I mean, there's still questions about what is the power of an endorsement ultimately, right?
That is true. Yeah. Like, that doesn't mean much anymore.
Right.
Mitch, Representative Jan Schakowsky announced her retirement this week. But we expected this, didn't we?
Right. Yeah. Jan Schakowsky, she's about to turn 81. She'd kind of been signaling that she'd be stepping down for a while. And yeah, this is kind of another, it's just like a real game of musical chairs across the congressional delegation and the entire state. We've seen one state senator, Laura Fine, throw her hat in the ring. She announced her candidacy a day after Jan Schakowsky announced she'd step down.
And then she's joining social media content creator Kat Abu-Ghazaleh.
Correct, who, you know, doesn't live in the district or recently moved to the district, is kind of viewed as sort of you know, folks have very pejoratively described her as a carpetbagger kind of coming in, trying to sort of steal a seat from a, you know, a district that she's not terribly familiar with. But she's,
I mean, and she announced before her intention was out there before Schakowsky had even stepped
down.
She was
very clear.
Right.
She was like, when you leave, I want that.
And this is like a really
comfortable. Even if you don't, I want that.
This is a seat where Jan Schakowsky held that seat for almost 20 years, her predecessor for, again, for decades. You know, this is a very comfortable, progressive seat. So I think we're going to see a lot more establishment Illinois Dems throw their hat in for this. Evanston Mayor Dan Biss is almost certainly going to run. More.
Overall, the tone is, and the Democratic Party is reckoning nationwide, where do we go? What's next for us? And there's a push for a new generation, new voices to step in. And so I think a lot of these retirements we see is a response to that. And I think voters overall pretty happy with it.
DePaul University President Robert Manuel testified before Congress on Wednesday. He got quite the pummeling, didn't he, Brandon?
Yeah, it was definitely heated. It was all around those student encampments that happened over, you know, Gaza protests on the Lincoln Park campus. They lasted like over 2 weeks. So Chicago police came in and like cleaned them up. You later had the school being sued by two Jewish students who say DePaul failed to protect them from attacks they faced because of their support for Israel. And so a lot of the heated questioning of this president here, Robert Manuel, was around that issue right there, claiming that he supports an environment around anti-Semitism. He admitted that he's made mistakes in his handling of the campus protest. It was a 3-hour long hearing, but he really didn't please either side here, which is really fascinating here. He made both sides upset. So those who feel like DePaul and him are inflaming anti-Semitism feel like his apology, especially directly to these students, was inadequate. Meanwhile, student groups on campus who represent Palestinian rights, they believe that they were thrown, quote, under the bus by him and not stood up for their First Amendment rights.
Oh, wow.
So he really, I guess, tried to walk that tightrope and had a difficult time, like many university presidents are.
Yeah, it's a really difficult situation that, that these schools are going through. We saw, of course, Northwestern go through the same sort of hot seat a year ago.
And, you know, a lot of it's around the it's First Amendment issues.
Yes.
Protest is a First Amendment right. And a lot of Democrats are arguing out there that this effort to attack these institutions is to silence free speech around criticism of Israel and their campaign against Palestinians in Gaza. You know,
yeah, they're saying Republican legislators that they're using anti-Semitism to control what's taught and what's said on college campuses.
And the irony is, some of these same Congress people also flirt with anti-Semitism, and Trump has flirted with anti-Semitism as well. So, who's really holding the moral line here is the question.
Nobody. Mitch, you just finished up an investigation. This was into a controversial rate hike at suburban natural gas utility Nicor. What's going on?
So Nicor, this is a suburban provider, more than 2 million customers across northern Illinois, most of the suburbs. Every year, or actually whenever utilities want to raise rates on customers, you know, the bill that you get every month, they have to go to the Illinois Commerce Commission to basically ask for approval. And so Nicor did that in January, and they asked for a $323 million rate hike, which would be the highest ever granted in Illinois if it happens. And basically, for the rest of the year, consumer advocates who are against that rate hike and Nicor are going to be arguing this case to the commission. It's a very long, drawn-out process. They really get into the weeds. It's very difficult to decipher. But basically, consumer watchdogs at the Citizens Utility Board and the Illinois Public Interest Research Group this week, they made their case to the Commerce Commission, basically saying that Nicor could ask for a rate hike that's less than half that amount, and basically still do the work and get the profit that they need to operate. You know, the interesting thing about utilities like this is, you know, it's a publicly traded company owned by a Southern company, a massive corporation based in Atlanta. You know, with these rate hikes, they can essentially set their own profit rates, and that's, you know, not really a privilege that most companies get. And, you know, Watchdog's argument here was that, you know, if they just lower their profit rate essentially by 1%, that would save ratepayers upwards
some
of $50
money.
Million.
Yeah.
Dollars. So, you know, this is an argument that they're going to be making for the rest of the year. You know, we've already customers in Chicago and beyond have already seen increases to their ComEd bills, to people's gas bills last year. You know, that was another case that was settled last year. So now it's a matter of seeing just how much suburban customers are going to see their bills go up by.
Oh, yeah. Well, since you're here, Chris, I want to turn to the arts for a little bit. Steppenwolf Theater was awarded a huge honor this week. Fill us in.
Yes. Well, Purpose, which was a play based on the family of Jesse Jackson, the great civil rights leader, and the subsequent generation in that family. And it's a play by Brandon Jacob Jenkins. Directed by Felicia Rashad, that was premiered here at Steppenwolf Theater. And it was announced about a week ago that it had won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama, which is the first Steppenwolf commission to win that prize since Tracy Letts' play August Osage County, which I think was 2008, if I'm remembering correctly. It's and not only that, it did very well at the Tony Award nominations last week, too. And,
wow, that's
Glenn
great.
Davis, who is the Steppenwolf artistic director, all-around great artist in Chicago, he got nominated for a Tony Award. Harry Lennox, who is, of course, one of our great actors and spends a lot of time in Chicago these days, he's nominated for a Tony Award, too. And, of course, the play itself is nominated for Best Play. I thought it was an incredibly gutsy play to take on, you know, a civil rights icon like Jesse Jackson. It got a little bit less about him in New York, and I was suspicious that they were worried they were going to get into legal trouble in some way. But it
was interesting. I saw it too.
You saw it here in Chicago.
I saw it here in Chicago. I talked to Harry Lennox as well as Glenn, and you know, I was entertained.
It
was a great play.
It was a great play. I really enjoyed it.
And on a deeper level, it's about being the kid of a very famous father. That's what it's about, right? And about having to live up to the previous generation above you. And maybe that's not your bag. Maybe you'd rather go take photos, or you'd rather be an arts person. You shouldn't have to deal with all the stuff and all the sort of exposure. And I think kids of politicians, particularly, and civil rights leaders, than any public figure, often deal with those things.
Yeah, they feel the pressure to follow in their dad's footsteps or their mom's footsteps and do the same thing, you know, or just be out there publicly. So congratulations to Steppenwolf. We've also got some not so good news, Chris, from the arts world. Organizations are just reeling from losing federal funding. Talk about how tough the last few months, not even just the last few months, the last few years has been for arts organizations.
Well, I think, you know, arts organizations have been hit by so many things at the same time. Number one, of course, was the COVID pandemic, which changed people's habits. People became more homebody. It got harder to get people to come out. It got harder to get people to come downtown in Chicago. That happened. That was number one. And then we found a lot of foundations and philanthropies moved away from arts funding per se, more into social programs, which of course is their privilege. But of course, a lot of arts groups found it harder to get foundational support. And then, you know, city support got a little less in some instances, and it wasn't ever that great to begin with in the arts. Mm-hmm. And then what's happened now is that the Trump administration's gone after the National Endowment for the Arts, National Endowment for the Humanities. And I think, you know, I think what really galled people this last few days was, let's just stipulate that Trump is entitled to remake the NEA as he wants it. You know, Brandon Johnson said the other day that, you know, whoever he wants running Chicago Public Schools should reflect the policies of his administration. That's what he said yesterday.
Okay.
Trump says a version of that, this agency should represent my policies. Let's just stipulate that that's okay. I'm not saying it is. Let's just stipulate it. What they did, though, was they took grants that had already been approved, already where people were at opening night, where people had spent the money.
Right.
And they clawed it back. And they said, that grant that you thought you had, that's been rescinded.
Terrible.
That no longer applies. Oof. And that's just not, it's un-American.
No.
It's un-American. And I think anybody, you don't have to be a big arts supporter to see that that was wrong.
Yeah.
And what they should have done, they should have finished the cycle. Then they could say, hey guys, you know, things have changed. We want this kind of application. But to claw back that money, that was hard to justify, whatever your politics.
My goodness. One more arts-related topic, but arts and crafts, Chris. The Trib had an editorial about the joy of Joanne Fabrics.
Yes.
Why write an editorial about this retailer going out of business?
It's going out of business imminently, I think.
Besides the fact that I'm obsessed with Joanne Fabrics, and I know a lot of other people
you're
are.
You're going to be on, you're going to have to suffer through withdrawal, because by the end of May, there will be no more Joanne Fabrics left, or Joanne, as it became known.
Yes.
You know, and it's just a sort of sad tale, because people were very fascinated, like you. They became obsessed with that store. And it, you know, I looked into the history of it. It's a sort of a tortured history involving private equity, as so many of these things are, and the sort of the change in times, the diminishment of that, mm-hmm. of crafting in general, because crafting was really hot for a while, really hot. And they rode that wave. And then, you know, I blame the phone, as I do for so many things. So people don't, you know, no one's got pincushions anymore. Everyone's on their phone all the time. And that was
as a preteen and a teen, I was going to Joanne Fabrics.
Cross-stitching.
Yeah. Did you
have the tomato pincushion?
No, I did not.
My grandma had it.
I wasn't that bad.
So, sadness.
Yeah, so I got to pay Joanne a visit before
Quickly.
The end of May.
Quickly.
While we're talking about struggling businesses, Brandon, I want to talk to you about the Silver Room in Hyde Park, because that's a tough situation.
I mean,
too.
Speaking of the arts, you know, I mean, Silver Room has been an institution in Hyde Park, a cultural institution, an arts institution for nearly 30 years. They threw that great block party that started from the store to that whole Hyde Park corridor and then expanded out to the beach.
Yes.
Eric Williams, he had to end it in 2023 because of he was paying for it out of his own pocket, and it got too expensive.
That was a huge party.
And now he's expressing a dire need to raise $200,000 within 30 days to pay down the festival's debts, including paying artists, vendors, and things like that over time. His ultimate goal is to raise $1 million to help sustain and grow Silver Room and hopefully bring that festival back, which I know a lot of people would love to see.
Mm-hmm.
One of my vivid memories of first moving to the city was going to Hyde Park for that festival. It just felt like a celebration of black business and joy and the arts.
It's one of the first things I did because I got here, it was very locked down in mm-hmm, Chicago. And mm-hmm. once it opened up, folks were like, oh, you should check out the Silver Room block.
It was a premier summer thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So he's raised $20,000 so far. A lot of support coming in, but $200,000, that's a big goal in 30 days. I'm hoping they can get that, because Silver Room is so valuable. So valuable.
Before we let you go, I do always like to ask the stories that you're watching out for next week. What comes to mind for you, Mitch? What's on your plate?
I'm actually going to be pitching in on some White Sox coverage next week in Cincinnati.
Is it because of the Pope?
You know, it's not because of the Pope, okay. But now I'm extra excited to talk to some White Sox who have really got the full force of the Vatican behind them now and what that could mean for the franchise. You know, this is a franchise that's been desperate for any
World
they
Series.
Need help wherever they
Here
can get
they come.
It. Yeah.
Chris, what about you?
I'm working on this. We're working together on this editorial on the new guy at O'Hare, Michael McMurray, who's the new commissioner of aviation, talking a bit about what's been going on at Newark Airport, where air traffic controllers have been telling people it's don't fly through Newark. And, you know, our take on O'Hare, I fly a fair bit, and I think O'Hare's been doing well. And I think, in general, job number one for this guy is keep it going. Don't mess it up. Mm-hmm. But we've also got this massive construction project that's going to go on through, I believe it's 2034. There'll be construction at O'Hare. So it's a massive job, and that's a very important airport,
oh, yeah.
Huge part of our economy.
Yeah, that'll be one to watch for sure. What about you, Brandon?
Mine's a little lighter. Chicago, the Chicago Sky season opener next weekend. They go to the Indiana Fever.
Yes.
They had a bad season. Some would say they're still in a rebuild, but from what I've observed and talking with Coach Tyler Marsh and the team there, I think they're going to be better. And they got a good shot to make the playoffs this year. But that's going to be a good early test. And, you know, this is a big time for the Sky. They're trying to build a new facility, practice facilities. They keep up and trying to maintain that whole player empowerment movement. The WNBA itself about to go into a league-wide collective bargaining situation.
Oh, that's right.
Potential pausing of games in the future if we see a rift, new teams being added, expansions.
Oh, there's a lot going on there.
There's a lot going on there to watch in the future.
Well, that is it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Brandon Pope of WCIU, Chris Jones of the Chicago Tribune, and Mitchell Armanchout of the Sun-Times. Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
Thanks. Great to be here.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Ethan Schwab. Every Friday, Reset brings you the news that you need to know in under an hour. So make sure you're subscribed so that you don't miss out. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a good weekend, and thank you for listening.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.